Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Well, we might be the driest continent on Earth, but we're also the world's heaviest water users. So today you'll hear warnings that we will run out of water unless there are big changes to the country's agriculture and the way we use water in the cities. That's coming up. Also ahead in our series on family farmers of the world, we'll take you to Denmark today. You'll meet a mink farmer. Now, this is certainly an unusual farm by Australian standards, but some of the challenges being faced there will sound very familiar. We've got that and more coming up today on Bush Telegraph. Well, the federal government has released the review it commissioned of the Australian curriculum, which promotes a back-to-basics approach. This was the Federal Education Minister Christopher Pyne speaking on AM yesterday.
There's a lot of common sense in this review around trying to get more depth rather than breadth in primary school and in making the themes fit the curriculum rather than the other way around, making the curriculum try and fit the theme.
So there's been a lot of discussion and focus on this report in the last 24 hours. Most of it has been about how this sort of curriculum would be implemented in the cities. But we've asked a couple of experts in rural education to examine the review of the national curriculum and share with us what they make of it and consider if a national curriculum is even relevant to regional and remote communities. Sarah Cook and her family live on a station near Mount Isa in Queensland. She's also involved in a network of rural teachers and parents in Queensland. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Cam.
Philip Roberts is also with me, Assistant Professor at the University of Canberra, where he researches rural education. Philip, welcome.
G'day, Cam.
Sarah, let's start with you. Your education alliance, Distance Education Alliance, includes places like Charters Towers, Longreach, Mount Isa School of the Air. How are kids taught in your part of the world?
Right. So the Education Alliance that I'm talking on behalf of today represents seven schools of distance education. In our homeschool rooms, we use computers and telephones. And when we're on computers, we're mostly using chat rooms or using the materials, yeah.
Mm. So the teachers, tell me about what type of teachers will be teaching the kids.
Untrained home tutors, mostly. So if you're a parent, you will be... for your job first and foremost is to be a mother, and then your role in the schoolroom is to deliver the materials on behalf of the school. So the teacher will work with you, but you're the person in the schoolroom delivering the materials, yeah.
So before we touch on the findings of this latest review, how would the teachers and by extension the parents, the home teachers, how do they cope with the demands of including all the demands of the current curriculum?
Well, there is no separation from home and school life in the schoolroom. They happen in the same place and they're between the same people. So this in itself is really challenging. We found the introduction of the Australian curriculum quite difficult, actually. It happened at a bad time. 2012 was when it was introduced to Queensland. So we're in the middle of a fairly difficult drought. It was delivered to us without any prior training. So there was an expectation that you would be able to deliver those materials without knowing really where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if I've answered your question.
But did you struggle with the type of things that you were being asked to teach, or just the sheer volume or extent of the curriculum?
Both, really. So there was lots and lots of content, but also, the C2C was written with the intent of direct teaching, so there was an expectation that an experienced teacher would deliver those materials, but we as home tutors didn't have that experience, and the delivery method was quite different to the previous set of materials.
Can you give me an experience of how you might have struggled?
In our first year, my child was in grade 3, so first of all, he wasn't at the expected level according to the Australian curriculum because there was such a big leap. And the second thing was that we had to be right across things like persuasive text, which it's a learning as well as a teaching, so I had to understand persuasive text rather than trying to convince people.
Can you tell me what it is, a persuasive text?
You are so putting me on the spot. well, I suppose... I don't really want to answer that because it's a bit of a loaded question. We would probably say, as untrained home tutors, that it's tied to NAPLAN.
Okay. So is there, in what you're saying, is there a problem with trying to impose a national standard in a small rural classroom where it might be homeschooling going on or parents doing their best to teach the kids?
You know, we want a rigorous curriculum in the bush. We want the best outcomes for our children. We are very involved in our children's lives and we invest a lot in their education. I think the problem with the introduction of the Australian curriculum at the onset was that we were unprepared for it. The schools were unprepared for it. The students were unprepared for it. We as home tutors were unprepared for it. I think that we are moving forward in a positive way. I think the findings of the report have shown, and I received an email this morning from a colleague of my school, a home tutor, saying the report found what we could have probably told them in the first term. It was too content heavy. They were missing areas in phonics and in the early years. There was not enough focus on literacy and numeracy. We didn't find it conducive to children with learning support needs. Yeah, there was a lot. We do need a rigorous curriculum, but there was just a disconnect, I think, at the onset. But we're getting there.
But so what, to some extent, was it based on an assumption that rural, remote kids and their families have the resources and the skill level of a primary school in Sydney or Brisbane?
Yes, I think that's a good point. There was lots of assumptions. There was an assumption that we in geographically isolated environments had the infrastructure. There was an assumption that the teachers had the expertise. There was an assumption that the children wouldn't be as impacted, I think, as they were, because there was a big stretch, I suppose. Education Queensland told us afterwards that it was inevitable that they agreed that there was a giant leap. There was what they talked about was faced with a 2-year learning leap in some cases, and admitted later that it was inevitable, albeit an unfortunate consequence of implementing the Australian curriculum. It had to happen.
Okay, but from what you saw yesterday, you feel it's been redressed to some degree, do you?
I do. I think, you know, it takes all members of all stakeholders and all members of the community to work towards better outcomes, and I think that we are working towards it. But I think that people in distance education paid a fairly hefty price. There's a lot of difference between dropping your children off at the schoolroom gate or school gate and taking that child through the school day. You know, we know those children better than teachers. We are the people that report back to the teachers. So I guess we saw a much rounded view, impact of the introduction of the Australian curriculum in the bush.
You're hearing from Sarah Cook here from the Schools of Distance Education Australia. Sarah's based in Mount Isa in Queensland, and we're discussing the reaction from rural Australia to the recommendations to the review of the national curriculum that was released yesterday. You heard Christopher Pine talking about it on the ABC yesterday. Philip Roberts is also with me from the University of Canberra, an expert in rural education. Philip, I wonder if the sorts of challenges Sarah outlined there, how common you think they are in rural areas?
Cam, I think they're very common, especially in the distance education area and the small schools area. You've got that issue of, you know, multi-year classrooms where teachers are teaching all primary school with 6 or 7 kids in one group, or as Sarah's talked there with the distance education parents, you know, they're doing a crucial role. It, you know, the school is providing the basic framework for a lesson or the key structure of a lesson, but it's the parents that are then making that knowable and understandable to their students, their children. They're reinterpreting it with them. And I think that's the interesting thing around the national curriculum is we've got this one nation view, but it's what parents like Sarah do in linking it to what their kids know, the life they live, where they live. That's the crucial thing. It's not actually drawn out.
So is it a flawed notion? Because if you develop a national curriculum, it makes sense that it will be weighted towards the needs of the bulk of the population, which are city-based. Is there a need to maybe divide it between the city student needs and country student needs?
I think in any curriculum discussion, there's always a compromise because curriculum is a high-level decision around what nation we want to represent and who we are as a nation. When we make that one and make it the same across all jurisdictions around the representation, the nation, what we do, then that becomes problematic. So it doesn't have to be weighted towards the city. You know, there's clearly, I'd say, a cosmopolitan orientation going there, and I suppose more people live in the cities. But where do rural kids see role models and so forth? You had a discussion a few weeks ago about the app with George the Farmer and Dirt Girl, and it was quite interesting that both people there talked about how the kids didn't have rural role models. So if we don't have that aspect in the curriculum, then where do kids from these communities see themselves? Where do they see their futures? And that's the concern.
So is the question where that comes from, where the push to include that type of learning in the curriculum? Does it come from Canberra or from state governments, or does it come from the teachers in the local community, I guess?
Yeah, it's a real compromise. You know, we might have a national curriculum, but every jurisdiction realistically interprets it in their own frameworks and own documents. So it's a multi-phase thing, and nothing will happen quickly. But the key to really good teaching, and as Sarah was mentioning there, is it's what happens in every classroom. It's whether the teachers and the parents, in Sarah's case, you know, reinterpret that. You know, use local examples. You know, talk maths about, you know, out in the field with the sheep or so forth, and using those sort of examples that are relevant to their kids. Whether they're writing about beaches and billabongs or they're writing about rivers in their literacy lessons. It's this sort of, you know, work that teachers do that make it meaningful. The concern, I suppose, is with all the talk around, and Sarah mentioned NAPLAN and ranking and all this sort of, you know, global economic orientation, that some of those local issues that are important and meaningful to kids, you know, teachers get orientated towards those other pitches and sometimes don't engage in that level of detail that they need to with the local stories, the local history, the local culture.
So, Sarah, how do you try to include a local view of the world in your teaching?
Well, we, as I said before, have a real sense of responsibility. So we try and follow the materials as closely as possible, trusting that the teachers are giving us the best advice. So we don't deviate a lot from the materials that we're given. And I think Philip's touched on some really important things there. Trying to contextualise it hasn't been easy, but taking that further, trying to understand what we should let go of and also what we should dig into a little bit further and investigate a bit further has been hard for us as well.
Philip, we've had this, the way the national curriculum's been run, this focus on Asian engagement and Indigenous history. How relevant have those priorities been for rural education and people in Sarah's situation?
Well, you know, obviously in the rural context, there's probably a lot more people engaging every day to day with Indigenous cultures. So it's really important that we have a respectful community orientation happening there. And Asia is also an important market and orientation for rural communities. And it's that balance we've always got to make, isn't it? That we want our kids to have, you know, great futures in the whole of the Australian nation, but we also want them to value where they come from and the places that they come from. As an example, the other option there is also sustainability in the curriculum. And we've just done some work looking at that in rural communities and getting rural communities' views around sustainability. And you find in the curriculum that the way it's used is a very, you know, environmental scientific view. But the way that rural groups and rural communities are using the term sustainability is a very multifaceted, deep, rich, integrated idea of sustainability. You know, they want to maintain the farm, to maintain the community, to maintain the lifestyle. So if that's not represented in the curriculum, and, you know, you could say that it's very environmental there, you've got that conflict between, well, communities want to maintain the whole of their base, whereas the curriculum is pushing a very environmental focus, which could be implicitly critical of some of the things that rural communities do. And that's, you know, that's not a situation that works well for everybody involved.
Could certainly put a teacher in a difficult situation.
Yeah, and I've certainly had discussions with teachers that have been in uncomfortable situations when, you know, they're pushing environmental issues that are mandatory in the curriculum and still are in the revised one, as I can see.
What do you mean by an uncomfortable situation?
Sustainability issues around maintaining water or water allocation or certain land use issues, which are dominated by a very urban view about sustainability, you know, maintaining the natural environment, Whereas you talk in this sort of work that we did with the rural community groups that, you know, they're just as aware of the need to maintain the land, but they also need to maintain the land to maintain the business and to maintain the community that is there. And that broader picture sometimes gets lost in the concerns that emanate from the major capitals.
Sarah, have you ever found yourself in a situation where what you're required to teach actually contradicts or competes with your personal views?
Absolutely. We were very, very concerned about the values imposed in the Australian curriculum, which flowed through to the C2C, the resource that we use. Probably in the first year, and maybe the second year as well, was when I received the most phone calls of complaints. People were in tears. They were feeling really compromised that they had to instruct their student to do certain things that were entirely against their family values.
What type of things?
Well, for example, forcing children at a young age, asking them in order to receive a mark for a certain piece of work in grade three to apologise on behalf of the Australian community for wrongs that have been done in the past. And there wasn't any question that there was wrongs in the past towards our fellow Aboriginals. The question was, should we be influencing their values on this really loaded topic so early on? And people felt really strongly about that. It was just uncomfortable for the home tutor.
So when you see the latest recommendation saying a removal of the cross-curriculum themes of Indigenous sustainability and Asian perspectives, do you see that as a recommendation that would make that would address those issues, those problems that some families face?
Yes, and I think that we like those themes, but we need to consider them separately, and we need to consider them at appropriate times. I think that it needs to be the children need to investigate and research and thoroughly understand, but they need to be mature enough to know how to do that.
Mm. Philip, isn't the danger, I guess, could be that if you end up with a very rural or remote take on the curriculum, that you then have children that are taught in quite a different way than the cities and potentially excluded from further opportunities in life?
Yeah, I don't think the issue is one around how they're taught. I think that it's always been the teacher's decision as to, you know, the examples that they use, what sort of texts they use, what sort of stories, the way they structure investigations. The key thing is the key concepts and skills. So, you know, an understanding of physics, chemistry, literacy, numeracy. These things are beyond the examples that we use there. So taking, for example, Sarah's point there around the Indigenous cross-curriculum priority. Now, you've got a value being imposed as an end outcome rather than it being orientated towards, well, investigation, as she said, in a, you know, a meaningful way, looking at various perspectives and coming up with multiple interpretations. That's a process that teachers can do that respects everybody, as opposed to saying, here's what you need to know and what the outcome has to be. So it comes down to empowering teachers and reminding them that they can do that. And I think that's where we get lost sometimes. We don't push that line enough. We're too worried about, you know, what is the outcome that we must have. You know, the history debates there around, you know, what is the nature of the history that we must have. And history is about evidence, discussion and debate. So.
And Cam, could I just add to what Philip said?
Yeah, by all means.
As a home tutor, we are compromised. We feel, like I said, obligated to deliver according to the curriculum and according to the teacher's instructions. But we're kind of stuck in a rock and a hard place in many respects, and I think you really touched on it there.
So, Philip, just to finish with you, I guess from what Sarah said, I take it that Sarah's quite supportive of what she's read in the last 24 hours. On balance, how do you feel?
Oh, look, on balance, I think the review's pretty reasonable. There's not much there that's really surprising. There's the issues around culture and heritage that will probably cause some debate, but again, they were sort of foreshadowed when the review was done. I think what we have is an opportunity to sort of raise the discussion again around how do we represent the rural to the nation and to the communities themselves. You know, are they part of the story? You know, it's really important for kids to see themselves in the story. If they can't see their world represented, then, you know, that tells them that they're not part of that world. So balance.
It's a valuable discussion. It's a tricky discussion, but a valuable one to be having at a national level. Sarah, just before I let you go, I think, what did you drive to get in today? About an hour and a half or so?
Yeah, not too bad.
Yeah? So what's happening with the kids at the moment? Are they at school?
Yeah. And a list of jobs to do in their breaks.
Who's teaching them?
My sister's at home at the moment visiting, yeah.
So you juggle, hey?
Yeah, it's all good. Yeah. You know, and this is a thing, this is why I think it's important to listen to home tutors. We are there all the time. We know those students and that material probably better than the teachers a lot of the time, because we're actually, when I talk about teachers, I mean, you know, School of Distance Education teachers, because we're actually delivering the materials. So we're really hoping that out of the findings of the review, they'll really focus on more literacy and numeracy and reduce the content in primary school. They're some important things for us.
Sarah, great to get your insights. Thanks for taking the time out and joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Cook from the Schools of Distance Education Australia. And Philip, thank you as well for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Philip Roberts from the University of Canberra, an expert in rural education. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Time now for Rural News. Tony Allen's got today's rural news. Let's start with Indonesia, shall we, Tony? And the prospect of beef coming in from Brazil and India, I guess that's got some Australian people in the beef industry a little worried?
Yes. One of the advantages Australia have is that we do not have the disease foot and mouth disease. Brazil and India both carry foot and mouth disease, although in Brazil it's only in a very small area of the country. And each country has declared disease-free zones where the cattle do not have it. So the new law foreshadowed in Indonesia is designed to keep a lid on rising beef prices and boost local cattle breeding to allow cattle to be imported from Brazil and India. Now, Australia's cattle industry is still very concerned, though, about the risk of foot and mouth arriving in India and from there transmitting to Australia. Susanna Moss Wright is from the Australian Arab Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and she says Australia has a natural quarantine from livestock disease, but meat exports to Muslim countries could be threatened if foot and mouth got in.
If Australia were to lose its disease-free status, that would have an enormous implication for the Arabic market also, because under halal and Islamic law, it's forbidden to eat an animal that's diseased. If Australian animals were to lose their disease-free status, then our market preference would also fall away.
The northern beef industry, Australia's northern beef industry, it really does depend a lot on what Indonesia decides
to do. Yes, we're talking live cattle here, by the way, not boxed beef.
Yeah, yeah. A little later on the program, on Bush Telegraph, we're going to talk about Australia's water scarcity. Not so long ago, irrigators were basically offered the chance to take a payout and walk away from their land. Now they're now free to go back farming, if they like.
Yes, they have an interesting choice to make. Quite a few irrigators from places like South Australia and Victoria took exit grants from the federal government during the big drought of the 2000s. The grants of $150,000 were given out for farmers to leave the land. They had to remove all plants or crops or vegetation and all irrigation equipment from this land for 5 years to qualify for the grants. Well, the five-year ban is now up. So they have the decision.
Do I go back?
Mm. It's a bit like taking a redundancy and deciding whether, waiting out the period. And, Robert Gillis is a former grower who did take an exit grant. He says he wants to return to horticulture, but he and some of the fellow growers are finding that finding a viable crop these days and installing the irrigation equipment might be prohibitive.
There are a few crops out there that are better. Almonds are one thing that comes to mind. I believe there's quite a few people thinking about it. But then how do you finance it? It's a lot of money for trees, an irrigation scheme that's got to be made appropriate for the job. It's frightening.
Yeah, big decision to make, I guess, after having 5 years to think about it. Let's finish today talking bushfire. We're almost into summer. We've already seen some fires around the country in the south and southeast. Preparations, I see, are being made for the bad bushfire season.
Yes, more or less a little reminder that things could be pretty bad this summer because it's been so dry in parts of Queensland, New South Wales, and the drought is now semi-officially extending into Victoria and parts of South Australia now. At the weekend, firefighters around the Victorian-South Australian border from both sides came together to fight a mock blaze, effectively, and to have a bit of a meeting about what they're going to do this season. There's a lot of cooperation between the services going on because they do believe it's going to be a tough bushfire season. Country Fire Authority Operations Officer Mark Gunning says there's a lot to prepare for.
No doubt in the southeast of South Australia and along the Victorian border, we're in a state of dryness. We've had a very dry finish to the winter. We didn't get the rains we would have liked, and that's going to increase the fire danger. People need to start thinking now what they're going to do.
Okay.
It's time to look after the gutters and remove the stuff from your lawn and all that stuff.
Yeah, get working.
Get the tanks full.
All right, thanks, Tony. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN.
Hi, Fran Kelly here. If you're too busy to keep up with the big news of the week, then I'm here to help. On RN Breakfast, we talk to the newsmakers from around Australia.
We have to get over the illusion that the West is in a position to control what happens.
And around the world.
A huge cheer went up from the crowd.
Each week, I bring you my favourites.
The biggest barriers that I had was around the stigma and the shame associated with help seeking.
The best of the best from Breakfast. Fran's Top 5, we call it. You can find them every Friday on the RN homepage.
And while you're there, you can see what you might have missed throughout the week. On the Bush Telegraph page as well, you'll find that under the programs guide. Now, it was only a handful of years ago that many of us were putting a bucket in the shower so we wouldn't waste any water. We were even dobbing in the neighbours for watering the garden on the wrong days or washing the car on the wrong days, all that sort of stuff. But with some of the wettest winters in years in parts of Australia, not all of Australia, I'm aware of that, because of that, those wet winters, we've relaxed a little. The water crisis has fallen off the radar, you could say. But experts are predicting a new crisis. Australians use more water per capita than anyone in the world, which would surprise a lot of us, I think. And with increasing population, water security is fast becoming one of the most critical environmental issues that the world and Australia is facing. David Lambert from Australasia is a water management engineer, and he worked on a study looking at the future of water management and says there's a few things that we should be doing it. Daniel, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Cameron.
Let's talk about this report first. It points to a fairly dire global situation within the next 20 years.
Yeah, I think we face a lot of challenges in the water industry moving forward. And it's important to plan for the future rather than be reactive, like some would argue we were with the introduction of desalination plants in Australia in the last few years.
Mm. So how serious is Australia's water scarcity problem?
Well, if you look at climate change, for example, a lot of people are predicting that in the future we'll see the regularity of floods and droughts in Australia increasing to the point where they're almost triple the regularity that they're currently occurring. So major floods at the moment occur on average once every 17 years, and some are predicting that in future there'll be one every 6 years. And if you think about that from a rural context, that will have major implications on farmers throughout Australia.
Mm, but what does it mean for our availability of water?
Well, major drought. So we're likely to see periods of major droughts and periods of major floods. So in terms of scarcity in those periods, it'll make it very difficult to manage with the agricultural sector because there'll be significant scarcity.
Mm. So does that scenario, does that support the argument for more dams, bigger storages, so we catch the floods when they occur, we've got the water when it's dry?
I think it does. And I think it also, the argument for dams moving forward is that there is going to be increased demand for food in the future, not just in Australia, but in Asia. And we've heard a lot of talk in recent times in the political realm about Australia positioning itself as a food bowl for Asia. Mm. But it is likely to become a reality as we look at the significant population increase up there and the fact they don't have the land to produce the crops required.
Mm. Okay, so the demand for food means more water needed for agriculture. That's the argument, is it?
That's right. Mm. And it will also mean an increase in the price of food, which will help with the viability of farmers in Australia surviving and making a livelihood out of the agricultural industry.
Okay, so how do we go about it? If you've got a farming sector that needs more water to produce more food for growing population, where do we get the water from?
Well, as we talked about, there's plans for more dams. There's been a lot of work looking at water efficiency. So in Victoria and New South Wales, for example, There's been a lot of measures introduced over the last few years to line channels and also to transition some of them from open channels to piped, and that's had a major impact in terms of losses through seepage and also evaporation. And also it's to do with water management, looking at what are the right crops in the right areas for Australia, what are the right types of stock that we should be running, and what can be economically viable.
Is there evidence that we are growing the wrong things in the wrong places and running the wrong stock in the wrong places at the moment?
Well, there's definitely arguments for it. So you look at things like growing rice, and it's very water intensive, and places like Asia where there's much higher rainfall, it makes more sense for those types of crops to be grown there rather than in Australia.
You're hearing here from Daniel Lambert from Arup Australasia. It's a water engineer and the author of a report, The Future of Urban Water. It's a study looking at water management in Australia and around the world. Now, Les Gordon's also with me. Les is the president of the Rice Growers Association. How are you, Les?
Well, thank you.
What do you make of what you've heard there from Daniel?
Of course, I would beg to differ. I think he's probably wrong on a whole range of fronts. Certainly, he's right around water efficiency, but water efficiency is only part of it. And that's been an ongoing focus of ours for 20 or 30 years, certainly the whole time I've been rice farming. But it's not just about more efficient delivery of water. Let's split that into two parts in the first instance. Okay, so first part's about efficient delivery of water. And that's using the existing gravity system. He talked about channel lining and what have you. That's certainly one aspect you can approach.
Okay, and so that's using pipes instead of open channels, that sort of thing.
No, yeah. Still using open channels, but making sure that they're lined so there's no seepage and that they are reasonably fast moving to minimise evaporation losses. Mm-hmm. Because the minute you go to pipe systems then, you also have a significant energy component. Electricity's got dearer and dearer. Diesel's not cheap. So while it might be water efficient, it's not necessarily energy efficient. In fact, they're certainly not energy efficient. So if you start to take a broader efficiency perspective, it might be water efficient, but is it fully system efficient?
So here's your conundrum. How do you balance those competing needs?
Absolutely. Mm. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect then is, okay, what can you produce with that water? And he started to go to that point as well. Yeah, and let me use rice as the example, obviously, because I am president of the Rice Growers Association. The rice that we produce is a temperate variety of rice. It's high yielding, it's high quality, can't replicate it in Asia. Asia produces all the rice it can under the existing circumstances. A lot of money going into research and development for both temperate production systems and tropical production systems. Because the important part there is, water to us is A, one of our most significant costs, and B, it is one of our most significant limiting factors in terms of production. The more rice that we can produce per megalitre, the better. So you approach it from two directions. One is minimising water use, so shorter season varieties, different management techniques, those sorts of approaches. A lot of work being done growing rice under sprays, but once again, you come to that broader efficiency conundrum that we talked about earlier.
Okay, but you fundamentally disagree with an argument that Asia can produce rice more water efficiently than Australia?
No, it's a different production system, and they can produce more rice, but they need to also do a lot of varietal development, the same as we do, same as we continue to do, and there's a lot of international research and national research going into doing that. Now, the other trick that you need to be sort of a little bit wary of is this whole food bowl to Asia equation. I mean, depending on whose figures you use, currently Australia produces enough feed to feed somewhere between 40 and 80 million people. Now, even if we doubled our production, you only get to 80 to, say, 150 million people, and there's cities and countries in Asia that are as big as that. So even if we doubled our production, and we're not going to do that anytime soon, the ability for us to feed all of Asia is a bit of a... It's unlikely to happen. So you then start to say, well, what can we do? What we can do is we can focus on producing high-quality, value-added meals that will sustain our system, that we can produce economically, that will feed people, because that's what we do best. And that's certainly the focus, particularly in the rice industry. But in agriculture generally, it's really about focusing on that quality end of the market where the real value add is.
Daniel, if I can come back to you, what do you make of that argument that it's not as simple as just looking at the water resource and how water intensive a given crop is, that there's a suite of considerations that any farmer, Australian farmer, has to keep in mind?
No, I agree with a lot of Les's comments, actually, and my comment about Australia becoming a food bowl for Asia wasn't about implying that Australia can supply all of Asia. It's about the fact there's an opportunity for us to increase our production and that we're on the doorstep of Asia, so it will become a real economy for us that will continue to grow. And I think that in terms of looking at the types of crops, in terms of looking at the types of irrigation measures, in terms of looking at energy, they all fit into, they're all considerations that need to be considered in order to come up with solutions. One of the things that Les mentioned, which I did think was a good comment, was that focus that we're starting to have in Australia on those high value quality crops, and also in terms of livestock as well, is Australia has the opportunity to produce high quality, which we can get maximum return from when we export it into Asia and also when we sell it within the Australian market.
Okay, we've focused a lot, Daniel, on agriculture so far, but what about our big cities, you know, your Brisbane's, Sydney's, Melbourne's? Do we need to have a rethink there on how water is used and how water is recycled in the cities?
We do, and obviously a lot of our report considered those options, and we looked at four different scenarios for the future, and we worked with, in this particular study, we worked with Sydney Water to look at what they might look like and therefore what challenges and opportunities the urban water industry faced moving forward. And water recycling is one of those key considerations. In most of our cities at the moment, we have largely centralised systems, so major water treatment plants, major desalination plants. But there's also an opportunity for smaller decentralised systems in certain parts of those cities, which can be run cost-effectively. And with a number of those, we're looking at water reuse as an alternative, so black water and grey water reuse within those particular developments.
All right. Daniel, nice chatting with you. Interesting report. We'll make sure we link through to it on the Bush Telegraph webpage. Thanks so much for coming today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Cameron.
Daniel Lambert from Orup Australasia, one of the authors of The Future of Urban Water. And Les, thanks to you for joining us today as well. Les Gordon, who is president of the Rice Growers Association. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Cameron Wilson with you, RN and Radio Australia. As I said, we will make sure that we link through to that study on water use on our webpage. And while you're there, you'll also be able to listen to the earlier story on education and the national curriculum and how it perhaps works with the rural education system in Australia, if you missed that earlier. Now, look, South Australia's horse industry has got on the front foot to deal with climate change. It's come up with an action plan for its members. We'll hear from Julie Fiedler in a moment, who's the Executive Officer of Horse SA. But first, let's find out what it's actually like for a horse owner on the ground trying to prepare for a changing climate. I spoke earlier to Jacqueline Raphael from Gawler in South Australia.
The summers have definitely been getting hotter. When we first moved down here, sort of 45, 48 was the hottest. The last few summers we've regularly had days over 50. The rainfall's up and down, but this winter in particular was very, very cold, which is something that I've never felt before.
Wow, so you get the extremes, do you?
Yes, yeah. Yes, the extremes seem to be, they fluctuate quite dramatically at the moment. The seasons seem to be changing, but I think that's Australia-wide.
How do the horses cope when it peaks above 50 degrees?
We hose them down regularly. We've got lots of trees that we've planted around, so there's lots of shelter. Because we're on the plains, there's always a breeze. Yeah. No matter what the weather's like, there's always a breeze. So as they perspire, the breeze does cool them. They do have shady areas to stand in when they're out in the paddocks. When they're in the stables, we've got trees around the stables, but we've also got stables where we can put up shade sails to help keep them cool. We don't have enclosed stables. We have open stables. So, again, they get that breeze to help cool them down.
So where do you get your water from?
Water, every building, every outbuilding and basically any structure on the property has a rainwater tank attached to it. So we utilise rainwater a lot. We do have mains water, but that's getting increasingly expensive. Even our septic, because we're not on main sewage, we're on septic and we've got one of those EnviroCycles, so we can pump the water out to wherever we want to channel it. So we put it out onto shelter belts as we're getting them established. We used it on pastures when we were getting that established. Mm-hmm. We use every ounce of water. We waste none.
When you first heard of the action plan, the climate change action plan for horses, what were your thoughts?
Well, I'd never really thought about it. And when I went along to the course and spoke more and more with Horse SA, it was amazing, just things that you hadn't thought of that you needed to think of, and I think more people need to think about it.
Jacqueline Raphael from Gawler, a horse owner there in South Australia. Julie Fiedler's with me as well, who's the Executive Officer of Horse SA. Julie, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Good, good. Why did you suddenly decide? What prompted the idea that you needed a climate change action plan?
I guess a number of our members had been talking about it, so I guess they talk about things differently. The hay's cut a little bit later in the season, or they noticed that the bushfire behaviour had been a little bit different. So it just caused me to think about it from an organisational perspective.
So what predictions or observations have you based the action plan on?
In June 2012, we ran a workshop and we actually brought horse owners together with some SARDI scientists and Gary Muscatello from Sydney University. And that provided an opportunity on the day to match, I guess, scientific information with anecdotal information.
So we heard there a little bit about just how the higher temperatures make managing horses day-to-day problematic, but we didn't touch on things like disease risks at all. Do you prepare for changing in disease risk as well as the climate changes?
Yes. Certainly in South Australia in the last couple of years we've noticed some changes. After Cyclone Yasi, that must have changed conditions slightly, and we had Kunjun virus come through our state quite prolifically. And also too, the fruit bats that potentially carry Hendra are now roosting in Adelaide, which is not heard of before.
Yeah, but why, if you have a cyclone in the north of Australia, how does that affect South Australia?
I think Cyclone Yasi was particularly large and the tail actually whipped around to South Australians.
Okay, so then that led to these observations on the properties. Now, this plan, it seems to have sparked a bit of interest from horse owners in the United States. I hear they've followed suit, if you like, to come up with plans in the Northern Hemisphere to deal with climate change. What's happened there?
Yes, we actually, the work that we've done was picked up through Elaine Blicker at Horses Land, Horses for Clean Water in the United States, and through King's Conservation District, they actually ran a horse keeping climate change conference in April this year and had their own sort of guest list, and it was really good. It was actually based on all the work that we'd done.
So are you surprised then that you've got, say, the places in the Northern Hemisphere following suit but not so much other states in Australia?
Yeah, I guess it's one of those things. Sort of have to go offshore and come back on again. But I guess horse owners talk about climate change differently. They might talk about it as sustainable land management, or they might talk about it as building resilience into things that they do. So it's really the language that sits around it. I think you'll find that a lot of actions are already been undertaken.
So is that one of the keys there, that when you talk about the adaptation, you base it on observations on the property, resilience, like you say, try to avoid the use of the phrase climate change?
Well, it's not so much avoiding it, it's just embedding it into the language that is what horse owners use. So when people talk about the different seasons they're cutting their hay in or preparing their property for bushfires, you're talking about, well, how are you going to recover as well? So what are you putting into place that you can get back to business straight away?
Yeah. All right. Well, it's an interesting initiative. Thanks for telling us all about it, Julie. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Julie Fiedler, Executive Officer of Horse SA based in Adelaide. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN.
The United Nations has called 2014 the International Year of Family Farming. The second instalment in our series looking at family farms takes us to Denmark, a small Nordic country with a population of 5.5 million. Denmark is one of the world's wealthiest nations whose workers are among the best paid, but it's perhaps best known for the world-famous toy group Lego. Agriculture was once Denmark's largest employer, but not anymore. Manufacturing, pharmaceuticals and technology have taken over. Family farming, however, still plays an important role in Denmark. And today we meet Anders Tuning, a second-generation mink farmer.
Can you describe what you do, how you go about mink farming?
We have this farm of about 1,400 females, and which is a family size farm. I have no employees full time. I have a guy coming helping me in the season where it's very busy, but otherwise I'm just by myself. The average size of a mink farm in Denmark today is about 2,000 females, and I'm not. It's not possible for me to make it larger because the city is coming so close to us. Instead of growing, we are trying to make a very good quality pelts instead of a big quantity. And that's what is my challenge, and that's what keeps me happy.
So what's involved? Do you do the breeding and the feeding and the growing?
Oh, yes. The thing about mink compared to pigs and cows and hens is that the mink have this one-year cyclus. They only get in heat once a year in March. So that means that in the month of March, we are very busy breeding mink because they only are in heat for those 14 to 16 days in March. And then all the females will have their kids in the end of April until 10th of May.
The breeding, is that done, I take it from what you're saying, that's done conventionally? You don't artificially inseminate?
No, it's all natural. For those 1,400 females, we will have about 250 males. So they're quite busy in March. In average, a male has to breed about six females, and they have to be bred twice.
What is their behaviour like? What are the challenges with every livestock has its own challenges. What are the particular unique challenges to mink?
From an economical point of view, the big challenge is to make a very fine quality of fur. Of course, you need to have healthy animals as well. If you really do care about your animals and you do your very best, it really pays off.
But how long does it take to grow the pelt?
Well, actually, the kids that are born in May this year will already be ready to be pelted in November. When they are born, they are only about 10 grams, the size of my little finger. But in 8 weeks, they'll be as big as their mother, about 1 kilo.
Who buys the pelts? Where's the market?
For the recent years, the market has been China. A lot of it is just manufactured in China, and then they re-export it to Europe.
Hmm. Has that destination, that market, changed over the years? I'm imagining there was a time where mink was in high demand in places like Europe and North America, but that may have changed in recent times.
Oh, yes, exactly. 20 years ago, it was mainly United States, and Italy was a very big buyer because of the fashion. And Russia has always been in the market, and that's not so much because of the fashion, but because in Russia it's bloody cold, and there's nothing that beats a fur coat when it's very, very cold.
So there's two markets, are there? There's the high-end fashion, and then there's the practical use as well.
Yes, exactly.
How is the public interest and the public scrutiny of your farming practices? How has that changed?
It's pretty high, actually. We have had some years ago some very critical journalists that were trying to tell people that it was not done okay, the welfare was not okay. And that meant that our organization had been doing a very big job opening farms and telling people what we were doing and showing them around. Every time somebody asks me if they can come and take a look at my farm, I say yes. And we have a lot of school classes, we have people from Rotary or other organizations coming and seeing what we're doing because we have nothing to hide.
Is there any other product from mink? Is there any meat market, or is it all about the pelts?
Actually, there's quite a lot of fat on a mink body, and that is converted to bio energy, like diesel for cars.
So there's cars in Denmark powered by mink grease, is there?
Yes.
When did that start?
Of course, it's only a small amount of the diesel that is made of mink fat, but yes, it exists.
My guest on Bush Telegraph is Anders Terning, who's from Sealand in Denmark, a mink farmer there. Anders, you talked about the fact there are less people in farming these days. How hard is it to attract young people to your industry these days?
Well, it is quite a challenge. It's getting harder and harder to be self-employed because there are fewer but larger farms now. So it's kind of difficult for the young people to buy a farm. Mm. Another challenge in Denmark is that we have quite a few laws. It's very hard for us to start a mink farm or to enlarge it because of environmental laws. It can take several years to get your permit to start or to enlarge a mink farm.
Several years. So even if you can make the money stack up or you can access the capital and buy the land, you've still got the regulatory hurdles.
Yeah.
What is the future then for family farms in Denmark?
Oh, it is still families that are running most of the farms. It's just that they are getting bigger. When I started in 89, when I bought the farm from my father, we were about 5,000 mink ranchers in Denmark with an average size of 600 females. And then we had a very big financial crisis in the fur industry that lasted for about 7 years. And today we are only about 1,500 farmers left with an average size of about 2,000 females. I might be one of the last generations that wants to have a small farm like mine where I have to be there every day of the year. Today, the young people, they would rather have a big farm or work on a big farm where they can have their 37 hours a week and have their holidays and stuff like that. And well, I don't disagree.
So you have a son and a daughter, but you also have the heritage of your father started the mink farming, I think, back in 1938. So what's your feeling? Would you like to see your children follow in the family business?
It's not important to me, not at all. I don't really see a future where I have my farm, because the city is growing and it might, in 20 years, we might be in the middle of the city. So I just want them to find something that makes them happy.
So that's Anders Torrens, who's a mink farmer from Denmark. Today's farmer in our Family Farmers of the World series that we're looking at all week. This is because it's the United Nations Year of the Family Farm. Family farmers, according to the UN, produce about 80% of the world's food production and represent 9 out of every 10 farmers. So that's why they are so important. Still to come this week, you'll hear from some family farmers in PNG, and a really interesting story about how it's mainly the women that farm in this part of Papua New Guinea, and the challenge there is to get more men involved in farming so they can increase production. You'll also be hearing later in the week from a Colombian farmer. The main challenge there is actually staying alive. This is a farmer who grows crops in one of the most dangerous and lawless parts of the country, and there have been many farmers killed in that region. So you'll be hearing from the Colombian experience. And you'll also hear from a farmer in the United States who's facing the real challenge at the moment of just staying in business through the worst drought he can remember. So that's one that many Australian farmers will relate to. So that's still to come this week on our series on family farms around the world. Tomorrow on the program, speaking of drought, a new study out of the United States, a concerning study really, that suggests there is a much higher or a significant chance of what's called a mega drought in the northwest of that country, a mega drought being one that spans for 35 years. Records suggest the last time the United States experienced a mega drought is some 800 years ago, and yet the chances of seeing one within the next 30 to 40 years are now considered reasonable, or more than reasonable, quite high, actually. And the lesson to take out of that, according to these researchers, is that it's time to stop looking at historical weather and rainfall records to make planning and farming decisions for the future. There's also some warnings in this study for Australian drought conditions. So we'll have that story on mega drought tomorrow on Bush Telegraph. In the meantime, stay on RN. We've got news for you next, then The World Today. I'll see you tomorrow.
A wicked problem is not just a difficult problem, it's a problem where when you solve one bit, you create equally intractable problems.
And the wicked problem in question is what to do about the uncivil nature of online discourse.
We're not quite sure if this is the right forum for our readers to interact with one another, and if that's the forum that we as news organizations should provide.
Dealing with digital discord, that's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.